Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to introduce Peter Katzenstein, who was reminding me that he was an MSc student here in 1967-68. My first memory was of meeting him at a graduate student conference during that year. He tells me that he did not actually take part in the occupation of the old building during that year. The last time I chaired a public lecture here, the said candidate who was Turkish Minister for Economics had indeed taken part in the sit-in, but Peter was a little bit more detached from the conflict at that point. As most of you will know, he has worked on comparative politics of more than one region of the world, both comparative politics of Europe and comparative politics of Asia, with in particular some work on the comparison of Japan and Germany and their regional roles. Comparative politics is an old-fashioned term, and I'm happy to say that Cornell is in many ways an old-fashioned and sometimes unpopular American political science department. I say this because I was at Cornell myself, and I was indeed the Walter F. Carpenter Fellow for 2 years. Peter is now the Walter F. Carpenter Professor. Someone a few weeks ago, Peter, asked me whether you had been my supervisor at Cornell, and I thought I had aged very well, if they thought that. Peter is now the Walter F. Carpenter Professor there, a chair held when I was there by Marion Einaudi. I think you may have an Einaudi fellow in the audience who's here. I'd love to introduce him to Peter afterwards. But Peter, the floor is yours, and he's going to talk about a world of regions.
Thank you, William. Old-fashioned and unpopular. Old-fashioned, yes, but unpopular was not due to me, William. That was due to you. So. Now,
at the high point of the Hegel revolution, we were both.
This is true.
And we survived it.
Well, it's a great pleasure being back after close to 35 years. This building was actually the one where I would negotiate weekly the balance of power between going to the theater and eating, because it had the BBC Indian cafeteria was in back. And you could get one plate of biryani, which was an enormous amount of rice, with raisins. And that would keep you going for about 24 hours. And that would mean that you could go to the theater once every other day. The bedsitter in Islington then was going for £5 a week. My bedsitter was very close to the Arsenal football pitch. And reluctantly, I'm coming here tonight to give a lecture. I would rather be someplace else, but such is life. And then seeing Paul Taylor in the audience, Paul was my tutor at that time. And Paul had the benefit then, I think, of commuting an ungodly distance, so that he could raise a family while some of us were sufficiently well endowed that we could live not just in Islington. Most of the Americans actually are living on some fancy fellowship in Knightsbridge. This always struck me. I realized that class relationships in academia in Britain were just under the surface. But I did have a good year, and tomorrow at the seminar, I can actually talk more about the intellectual substance of it. But I'm glad to be back after 35 years and to see that the IR faculty has moved into somewhat more splendid quarters. So today I want to talk to you for, and I was warned, 35 to 40 minutes, and I've structured the talk so that I can bail out at any time to make the deadline, about a book which is been sitting in my head for a good 4 or 5 years, and which is now mostly but not fully drafted in first draft. So I'm extremely eager to try out the argument. I've tried it out in America in various seminars, and truth be told, it hasn't gone too well, which has something to do with the fact that Cornell is an old-fashioned and unpopular place.
And centrally isolated in wintertime.
And centrally isolated. So how should we talk about world politics? That's what my students asked. They asked it a decade ago, and they've asked it since 9/11. And the old conceptual maps have been erased by now. That is, the things which are used for teaching in the early mid-1990s are gone. The end of strategic bipolarity, or the victory of capitalism, or the new world order, or the clash of civilizations, all of that, I think, were important and interesting ideas for trying to get us out of a trap. The trap, of course, which comes from history in the way of thinking about the world for too long in a particular way. After 9/11, the same thing has happened once again in one of my areas, which are security studies. I had an article published in a journal called International Security this year. Last letter from the editor arrived in August, which said that was a fairly interesting paper. Would I mind taking out that stuff on terrorism? That clearly had nothing to do with international security. That is a letter which I'm framing for my study. I'd worked in terrorism for a decade, and that was the last of many letters which I was being informed that terrorism was nothing to do with international security. So that sort of paradigm is being shattered now too, certainly in America, less so in Europe, where terrorism was part of the process of Europeanization. The answer I want to give today is that this is becoming a world of regions and regionalization. Not that this is a particularly novel answer. I think it's existed before. And by regions, I mean a mixture of givens, that is, objective and cognitive interdependencies across a large number of dimensions. That is, regions are given and they are constructed. And in times of great structural upheaval in world politics, the constructed element certainly is a very important one. In what we have learned over the last 10 years or so, typically there is a contrast made between open and peaceful regions and closed and war-prone and poor ones, and like all ideal types, that has a benefit. It gets you some ways to think about the world, but I wouldn't overdo it. Most of the debate about regionalism is cast explicitly in economic terms. The Financial Times still, like the Wall Street Journal, likes to write about economic blocks, although there's not a shred of evidence that economic blocks are emerging. All the academic studies point the other way. But the historic analogy of the 1930s is obviously there when people think about an international order which might in fact be different from what happened in the last 40 years. And one looks around for anchors to reinterpret the present. So rather than focus on a narrow economic subject matter, I'm more interested in the broader sociological institutional dimensions of regionalism. And I'm setting up the argument indirectly. I think there are, in international relations and in international politics and in public discourse, two prevalent views of where the world is today. And one I would call the view of internationalization, and the other one, the view of globalization. Just take, for example, the work of Professor Held on globalization as one example. Internationalization being the view which most economists and political scientists subscribe to. That is, that view, internationalization, says there's an increasing amount of dynamic density in international relations, but there's nothing qualitatively new. Dynamic density means more exchanges across national borders, trade, migration, capital, information. It is a view, internationalization, which, you know, rationalist theories of international relations find naturally appealing. Most political scientists in America think that that's how the world is changing. It lends itself to thinking hard about the varieties of capitalism which are now more clearly in the view of economists, neoclassical and otherwise, and journalists, although people in comparative political economy knew about varieties of capitalism for the last 30 years, among other things because of the writing of Susan Strange. It is a debate which, if you're an internationalization theorist, covers a fairly narrow spectrum. Typically, people focus on the OECD, much less so on the Third World. And it risks overlooking new phenomena. That is, can the internationalization theory or metaphor really capture all of reality? Now, on the opposite side, you get the devotees of globalization, and they focus on economy, society, and culture, and typically either the erosion or the renegotiation of state sovereignty. And by now, I think most people focus on the second, that is, the renegotiation. It is only being branded a globalist or hyper-globalist means that you know that there's only one or two people who actually hold this view. Kenneth Omey, who lives a long distance away, can be branded a hyper-globalist. He cannot strike back, also he's not an academic. But most people are not hyper-globalists, they just get attacked that way, and with it, that position. It is a way of thinking sociologically in relational terms, not economically in terms of actors and attributes, a fundamentally different view of the world, analytically, I think. It looks at the transformation of collective identities and thinks that there are qualitative new things happening in the world. Shrinking of time and space mean that identities which once were firmly rooted are now up for grab, not that one identity gets replaced by another necessarily, but that identities get nested in particular in new, novel ways. Glocalization, the combination of global and local, which students of Toyota had discovered 30 years ago, becomes the metaphor by looking at the interaction patterns between different new developments in world politics and different and new ways of appropriating these developments in local politics. The focus is less on the regulative norms, which lawyers and economists like to focus on, and more on the constitutive norms, that is, the norms which create new actorhood. And finally, globalization theorists are open to the charge, often brought by internationalization theorists, that they may overgeneralize. That maybe the social processes they focus on don't cover quite as much of the empirical terrain as has been argued theoretically. Now, regionalism or regionalization, analytically certainly, and politically to some extent, provides an antidote to both of these theories. It's not a new theory. It existed about 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And the breeding ground was then, as it is now, Europe. And it had both its economic, functionalist, and its sociological, historical theorists. On the functionalist economic side, there was Ernst Haas, now a retired professor at University of California, Berkeley. And on the sociological historical side, there was Karl Deutsch, who was my PhD supervisor, who combined history with behaviorism in a new way and whose work actually in Britain today, particularly the work on security communities, still is being given an active reading. So the argument I wish to pose today, certainly in analytical terms, isn't in any way new. That is, the distinction between sociological and economic theories of world politics goes back, of course, 100 years, and its application to the interpretation of world politics was applied in the 1960s as it is now. Now, how would I go about thinking about the relationship between these three views of the world, internationalization, globalization, and regionalism and regionalization? One way, which is how my graduate students like to think, is to say, I want to find out which of these three views is right. And you set up the research so that you identify one of the three as being right. That is certainly how I thought about the world some time ago when I was a graduate student. But in my older and more wiser days, I've decided not to do it that way because it seems quite evident to me that internationalization and globalization are mostly different social theories about a political, economic, social, and cultural reality which is undeniable. There is more things moving across borders, and there are more identities up for renegotiation. I didn't want to spend 5 years denying the obvious. So it's not how one of these three or the other is correct, but rather my intellectual intuition tells me that globalization and internationalization together are affecting regionalism in some form. And this is what I want to talk about. As an aside, it seems to me that the debate between globalization and internationalization, which is the big debate, will never be resolved because the analytical criteria which scholars bring to the data are different. They often use the same data, but they interpret them differently. And therefore, this debate strikes me as a particularly unproductive one. The overall conclusion is that regionalism in Europe and Asia is open, and the openness reflects the international and global influences which these theories correctly chart, but possibly for different reasons. Now, how could I test or illustrate. I'm not sure which is the proper way. I'll be modest and say illustrate. You be the judge at the end whether I test it. This argument about globalization, internationalization, and open and closed regionalism. And I thought about it in the following terms. I would take easy case studies, that is, easy cases for globalization and internationalization theories. In fact, those theories which, if one reads this, the views of globalization and internationalization scholars, they become the prime examples in the development of their argument. Globalization focusing on a world without borders often mentions technology and mass culture. So I took those two. Internationalization theorists, looking at a world of nation states, often looks at security, both internal and external security, and cultural diplomacy. Now, I'm inventing this. Nobody looks at cultural diplomacy. This is a vastly understudied subject, but I needed a corresponding case study to mass culture, and I made this one up. And it turns out to be an extremely interesting case. These cases I applied to both Europe being very expansively interpreted, but not including Russia and the former Soviet Union, with a particular focus on Germany, and to Asia, again, expansively interpreted, but not excluding South Asia and Central Asia, and with a particular focus on Japan. So do the theories, globalization and internationalization, stand up to easy cases? If they do, my argument about regionalism obviously is in deep trouble. If they don't, I probably can make a strong indirect argument for the view which I'm holding. So I'm focusing on regions and countries in regions, Germany and Japan, in part for their obvious political importance. Asia and Europe are big and important places. Germany and state are big and important states in Asia and Europe. They are technologically dynamic. They matter during the Cold War. They matter after 9/11. They have taken issues of cultural diplomacy and mass culture particularly seriously. These are important questions for them. So let me tell you two or possibly three stories, one about technology, one about security, and depending on time, one about culture, but maybe only an abbreviated version, and you be the judge of it. But before you judge, I will draw out, having told the story, how I interpret the regional factors which seem to show up in the data. So the first case is about technology and globalization. Technology certainly is part of a global process. It is of direct relevance to issues of military power and economic competitiveness. Technological change pulverizes state borders, and technology has become over the last 40 or 50 years to look more like science. That is an activity that by its very nature is public. And international. Intellectual property rights, the porousness of national borders, even the difficulty of defense ministries to keep tap of national technological defense bases illustrate that technology is traveling, and traveling very quickly and across most borders. Furthermore, globalization theorists would always point to technology as the case where one looks at the creation of quote-unquote best practice, whatever that may mean, but it does mean the same practice all over the world. So here are two examples. First, to give you a flavor of what technology means in Germany and Japan. When I get up in the morning, I shave. In London, I shave with soap and a razor, but at home, I shave with a Braun electric shaver. The Braun electric shaver I bought about 30 years ago. It is the epitome of German technology. Never changes, very reliable, utterly boring. When I go to Tokyo, my students take me to the high-tech shopping districts. I don't buy the Japanese razors, but I am in awe of them. They wake you up. They boil the tea water for you. You can set your telephone next to your electric shaver. They do everything for you. They are technologically playful, and they become quickly obsolete. But it shows you that the technology culture in the two societies is very different. You want to go mass transit in Germany, the ticket machine is the same way all over the country, east and west, north and south. And the Germans like it that way. It is very predictable, it works, and it is boring. In Japan, because they have a privatized railway system, and you know, you take the subway in Tokyo, it's like the London subway, but there's 7 or 8 different companies running these subway lines. And they introduce new ticket machines at a product cycle which goes according to their own individual company logic. That means you have to learn how a new ticket machine works probably once every 18 months or so. Japanese like that. You know, they sort of say, that's interesting. How does it work? How does technology evolve? You know, foreigners find this very distressing, right? So it's a different technology culture. It has a lot to do, of course, with how Japan has conquered world markets in the last 40 years, that culture. Now, in Germany, technology means mostly interdependence. It means interdependence with Europe. It doesn't mean innovation. It means diffusion. In fact, the logos of Siemens, arguably one, if not the best run and most successful German company, is the best second. Don't be the best first. That's high-risk strategy. You might get shot. Be the best second. Let somebody else innovate. Then take that innovation and diffuse it across a very broad product range, which Siemens has, and make a lot of money. So technology transfer for the Germans is driven by the need to have access to protected markets and by cost considerations. That is, by considerations of global competitiveness. It's not driven by concerns about national control of policy. It's rather policy which is conceived of and implemented and institutionalized in European terms. One example in the late 70s, I think, was that the Germans closed down part of the semiconductor industry, which they had dubbed as being an industry of vital to national security and national competitiveness in the next century, or millennium, any big word. Well, they said, we don't have enough money. In any case, Siemens and Philips together are better than Siemens. Not necessarily in the marketplace, but they're better for Europeanization. So technology is part of a European integration process from the perspective of the Germans. It is also part of a Europeanization process from the perspective of peripheral states. I looked in some detail at the policies of the Southern European and the Central European states in the 1970s, 80s, and then after 1989. And what struck me in particular about Spain and the Czech Republic, for example, two states which were quite nervous about Germany, was that what mattered to them was getting the Germans on their side in order to join Europe. Spain in particular moved fully from one column, dominated by the United States, into the other column, dominated by Germany, without losing any sleep. This I found surprising. But for the Spaniards, it wasn't a big surprise. What mattered to them was getting the annual Marshall Plan from Brussels. And that required German assistance, so that the structural funds would in fact pay out to Spain after 1986, as they have. The payout in absolute terms is still the largest in the European Union. In proportional terms, it is less than the Portuguese one was between 86 and 92. Portugal getting 3.5% of its GDP from the structural funds, leading to a tripling of its GDP per capita in the first 7 years after accession. So neither from the perspective of Germany nor from the perspective of peripheral states was technology about nationalism, national security, independence. It was about Europeanization. Japan views issues of technology totally differently. Technology is about security, national security in particular, about lowering vulnerabilities and enhanced growth and development. Government involvement in this production of national security through technology independence, therefore, has always been very persistent and energetic. Japan, that is both the government and corporations, have resisted processes of international diffusion of technology. So if you go to Seoul, for example, or other capitals in Southeast Asia, but particularly to Seoul, you get bitter complaints over the last 20 years about the Japanese never sharing their technology. This kind of collusion, I think, is not a deliberate policy. As for example, Hatch and Yamamura write in their book on Asia and Japan's embrace, it's not that there is a spider in the center of the spider web, which brings everything Asian close to Tokyo. It's rather the institutionalized cooperation between actors and their self-programming, which says technology is so important you don't give it away for free. Actually, you don't give it away. You steal it. That's what all self-respecting poor countries do. That's what we did. That's what the Koreans are trying to do. You don't help them. If they can steal it successfully, good for them. But it's not something which is a public international good. This outlook, of course, becomes quite problematic as Japan becomes a regionally dominant technological state. And it's taken the Japanese a long time to understand the counter-arguments to this definition of their self-interest. So what you have in Japan and Asia, that is the Asianization of Japanese technology, is in fact the creation of Japanese production networks, especially after 1985 and the revaluation of the yen called Endeka, by which Japanese suppliers, first tier and second tier, moved out, particularly to Southeast Asia, in order to support direct foreign investment Japanese corporations had brought to Asia. That looks rather remarkably different from the process of Europeanization of technology in Europe. So I would conclude that the regional technology orders differ greatly in Europe and Asia. And this difference contradicts quite clearly, in my view, the expectation of globalization theory and the expectation of convergence, or the creation of standards of best practice. I also think that indirectly, although the evidence I've produced is not strong on this point right now, that the story I tell also undercuts internationalization theory. For the regional connections between different national models of capitalism are crucial for understanding these regional orders. So distinct regional patterns of technology and a distinct political logic. Let me move to the second story, the story about security and internationalization. Now, in terms of security, we know that there is one system, the Westphalian system, and state security is at its core. Since 1945, casualties in internal war, that is domestic war, civil war, have been vastly greater than in international war, although not by the reported 90-10 ratio, which I always thought was true. Don't use those data, it's wrong. I looked at the book, I mean, somebody alerted and corrected me, this was Josh Goldstein in his big textbook. He actually traced the statistics to the wrong source, which has been repeated. The ratio is roughly 50-50. Of casualties since 1945. Still, it is important to look at both external and internal security. And therefore, you cannot look at it in terms of the core paradigm of American international relations realism. You have to cast your net somewhat more broadly. And including 9/11 and all of that becomes obviously relevant. So how does the security order in Europe look in the second half of the 20th century? Well, it is a story of Europeanizing the German military-industrial complex. That starts in 1950 with the European Coal and Steel Community, which was lifting out of national control the two core industries which had helped make German warfare possible over the preceding 100 years. And it aimed at the Europeanization of the German army, with the European Defense Community, and when the French couldn't stomach giving up a French army, it ended up in 1957 with the creation of the European Economic Community. That is, the EEC was sort of the runt of the litter. It was a desperation move after the military-industrial integration of Europe and Europeanization of Germany had failed. Still, the outcome was that by the late 50s, when Germany had, you know, a national army of 300,000. That army was under NATO command, no German general staff. And it was deployed along the Central Front in a pattern where you had a German army corps always located between two friendly Allied army corps. All the guns being trained eastward, of course, against the threat from Russia and the Warsaw Pact. But just in case the Germans would go crazy again, all you had to do is turn the guns 90 degrees and you had the Germans. Okay. This was a deployment pattern which did not change for the next 40 years. So NATO as a both anti-communist and anti-German or German control institution. The consequence of this over 30 or 40 years was that the Germans fully accepted the internationalization of what you would call the core function of the modern state defense. It's become second nature. So in 1989, there's no great demand in saying, we want to have our own national army. What about the internal security dimension? Well, the internal security dimension gets wrapped up in the process of Europeanization, just as technology does. It starts, of course, with a British-German initiative in the mid-1970s. That is when the IRA starts bombing in London and when the Baader-Meinhof group and the successive generation of German radicals start bombing in Germany. That the ministers of interior and security meet in Brussels, or they meet regularly, as an intergovernmental, secret European coordination mechanism. Not so different from how European politicians were relating to each other in the late 19th century when the anarchists were doing similar things. It's not just central bankers who internationalize rapidly when crisis is at the door. But there was only the beginning, TREVI. William will remember the acronym. It's not the fountain in Rome, but it is something about terrorism, revolution, violence, international, right?
That's the explanation.
All right.
Really, the reason was Chairman, you remember,
who
was called
to
contain the Dutch.
Okay. Well, the Dutch were worried about German police integrating Europe. The German police had, in the early 1970s, created a big computer, the most advanced computerized survey system in Europe, and they used the dragnet search method to some effect in the first half of the 70s, not the second half. They used it to no effect after 9/11. And in the second half of the 70s, the Germans were on a mission to sell the system. They say, all you have to do is get us the extension cord, we plug it into a German computer, and we'll catch all the radicals. And the Dutch were saying, you tried that before, it didn't work out too well for us. So that particular technocratic approach to European integration actually didn't work. But the Germans persisted. They said, okay, if it doesn't work through technocracy, it'll work through politics. And they actually were the pushing force in Europe to create Europol, which was the regional organization of Interpol, which I think gets created in 1982. And from then on, you went on to Schengen, you went on to the Treaty of Maastricht, you went on to the Treaty of Amsterdam. And internal security is now moved into the first pillar of the European Union. And courtesy of 9/11, it's becoming high profile. We are talking about not the external security function of the state being internationalized, but the internal security function of the state. And these are the ministries in all European countries which are more nationalist than any other ones. So over the last 25 to 30 years, internal security has been Europeanized, not fully Europeanized. And in fact, interesting enough, the Germans are getting nervous about the degree of Europeanization. Still, I think the train has left the station. It's hard for me to see how once you set this legal mechanism in place, how it's going to be reversed. And certainly not in the current political climate. On the external security side, Europeanization came more haltingly. The WEU was nothing the Germans were very proud of. There were minor French-German moves. But then in the 1990s, under the bold leadership of Prime Minister Blair, Europeanization has come with the Saint-Malo Agreement, and all that has to happen is the Germans to pay for some airplanes and fund the defense budget, and there will be some rudimentary European striking force in place, I think, for peacekeeping and peace enforcement within the next 3 or 4 years. And the pressure from America for this to happen is quite strong. Charlie Kupchin's recent book tells you why. Now, in this whole story, what's missing is the German strategic interest. And that has a lot to do with the fact that Europeanization actually has transformed state identity in Germany on these matters more than in any other country, I think, in Europe, that is, any other big country in Europe. But it's rooted also in something else. And here I would point to the one international institution which the Germans actually left for Europe, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, 1975, which was an outflow of the German Eastern policy of détente, and which over the next 15 years, belittled as it was, particularly in by Americans, had a lot to do with the end of the Cold War. That period is not so interesting, but what is interesting is the period between 1990 and 1992, in which the OSCE redefined the conditions for peace in Europe after the end of the Cold War, overthrowing the international order of 1815. Henceforth, peace was a function of the internal attributes of states, not the principle of non-intervention, but the principle of democratic, peaceful, capitalist states was going to work in Europe. There was one state, by the way, which does not sign the Copenhagen Declaration of 1992, and that is Serbia, and you get the war against Serbia within 5 years. So you have, in fact, a redefinition of what security order in Europe looked like, and it's hard to sort of summarize the European security order, except I would say great institutional ferment. Many balls are in the air. It's not clear how it's going to work out. But the security order in Europe is under greater rates of change than any time in the last 200 years. Now, Japan and Asia provide a striking contrast to this. All quiet on the Eastern Front would be one way of summarizing it. No institutional ferment. In the 1960s and 1970s, you had a blurring of internal and external security domains. This was the decades of anti-communism, in sharp contrast to Europe, where, in fact, in those decades, internal and external security realms were quite clearly divided. In the 1980s and 1990s in Asia, on the other hand, you have had a much greater distinction between internal and external security, again, in sharp contrast to Europe. And why is this? Well, for the obvious reason that new states guard their sovereignty quite jealously and practice the principle of non-intervention, in sharp contrast to Europe in the 1990s. ASEAN and the Asian Regional Forum is an exception, but it's a very limited exception. No standards and no interventions are defined by ASEAN. In fact, the ASEAN Treaty of Amity is a stretchable document, and by including Cambodia and Burma now into ASEAN, that is into the ASEAN process of enlargement, it's quite likely that the principle of non-intervention will be reinforced. Now, what is, of course, baffling is that in the last 10 years, we've had peace in Asia and war in Europe. And zones and flexibility in Asia and borders and rigidity in Europe. This does not sit very well with a European audience, I know, but I still think it's true. And I infer from this that in periods of institutional ferment, it's harder to keep the peace. But it's also possible that Asian peace is built on weaker reeds than European institutional ferment. It is quite possible that the various balances of power, which are now prevailing on the Taiwan Straits, let's say, or the Korean Peninsula, or the South China Sea, may break down in short order, in part because of the role the United States appears to play, increasingly so. So what do I conclude from the security story? I conclude that regional security orders differ, that there is no globalization, and that national differences do not characterize accurately what's going on. That is, regional security orders differ, not national policies. Germany and Japan actually are quite similar in their approach to questions of war and peace after 1945. But it's the regional differences which interest me. 9/11, incidentally, would extend this argument. For Germany, 9/11 is a law and order story, not an evil states story. For Japan, it is just a big story. It's not a law and order story. So 9/11 plays a much bigger role in Germany, not only because Herr Arter was living in Hamburg, Germany, but also because it reflects politically on a different regional order. I could tell you stories about culture, but I won't. So how could one give me credit and say, okay, I'll take that the regional stories were different. Globalization and internationalization do not explain these differences. How can we explain them? And here I think that I would focus on the type and depth of institutionalization of regionalism in Asia and Europe. The constitutive principle in Asia I would call ethnic market capitalism. And this I think is a deep and at the same time a soft principle. And it plays itself out under two auspices for purposes of illustration only. The Japanese one, which I mentioned, Japanese keiretsu systems spreading ethnically, ethnic keiretsu systems spreading through Asia. But then there are the overseas Chinese, and they are arguably the much more powerful force in Asian markets than the Japanese keiretsu. They have been strong historically, and they are strong today, commercially, and certainly in capital markets. And the ongoing economic revolution in the South China, the littoral of China and Taiwan are an illustration of this. So this is a market system which is ethnically organized. In Europe, on the other hand, it's public law, not ethnic capitalism. And I would call this a shallow and relatively hard form of integration. And this would refer to the political integration processes which linking national capitals closer to Brussels, which are creating the European Court of Justice, in my opinion, probably the central institution in the long term, and the European Central Bank. Europeanization finds, of course, different interpretations. Britain has a different view from France, and Germany sits in the middle. That is, Britain wants a shallow and broad Europe, France wants a deep and small one, and Germany wants both, and is increasingly running out of money to pay for it. So this is a Europe I don't have to characterize. Here I just say the European polity does remind me very much of a type of system which I once studied in depth, small states, the consociationalism of small states. As Joe Weiler has argued in 2000 in a brilliant little piece, Europeanization is marked in political terms by top-to-bottom norms and bottom-to-top hierarchy of authority and real power. In Asia, by the way, you will not find that divergence between norms and patterns of authority. If you wanted to add substantive illustrative material to this view, I would just draw your attention to the different forms of sub-regionalisms in Europe and Asia. In Europe, regionalism is defined as Euro regions. Euro regions are institutionalized. They receive a lot of funding, and by the year 2006, I think that is up to 39% of the total EU budget. It is formal politics to counter the politics of markets, regional politics. In Asia, sub-regionalism is market-driven and informal, not institutionalized in law, not involving governments. New economic territories and international growth triangles are tolerated by states. In fact, they resonate with centuries worth of economic and social history in Asia. And so is the underlying conception of network structures which link different kinds of capitalist orders. These forms of regionalisms are easier to organize and they're politically much more attractive. So if one looked, as I do in the book, but won't do here now, at sub-regionalism, I think one put flesh onto the characterization of Asia as ethnic capitalism and Europe as public law integration. How can you explain these differences of the institutionalization of Asia and Europe? And I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to turn to power and norms, both at the international and the regional domestic level. That is, in Asia, Japan, until very recently, and still today, despite the report that Japan has just about died, still dwarfs everybody else. Let's say two-thirds of everything, roughly, is still Japanese. GDP, investment, you name it. And Asia is heterogeneous. Germany, on the other hand, accounts for about a quarter of everything in Europe, and Europe is relatively homogeneous. Furthermore, Europe has well-functioning Weberian states, with the possible exception of Greece, which needed, although it is the foundation of European civilization, needs some assistance in learning how Weberian states operate. I still think that the Greeks are the most imaginative, creative, political users of European subsidies. But the exception proves the rule. Greece, after all, was for 500 years part of the Ottoman Empire, which is why the Turkish case is so important and deeply troubling for Europe. So I think there are then institutional explanations for the difference. Let me conclude. Globalization and internationalization capture a partial aspect of world politics. I think its openness. The regionalism which I think exists and which is deeply institutionalized in Europe and Asia, certainly in the cases which I've looked at here tonight, which is technology and security, I would argue, points to important regional differences which create institutional orders in the world which differ. I've used here only Asia and Europe, which after all is about only 90 countries. But the conclusion of the book, and I haven't drafted the conclusion, and the section will be very broad, will seek to extrapolate this argument to Africa, Latin America, Central Asia, and yes, North America. Left unexamined is, of course, what is the proximate cause of open regionalism. I've only led you from regionalism to open regionalism. And here I would argue it is the nature of what I call the American Imperium. And this is a separate chapter which I've drafted. It is a mixture of territorial and non-territorial forms of governance, which the American decision makers after 1945 used very self-consciously in order to create, around different principles, an order in Asia organized around the principle of bilateralism or unilateralism, and in Europe organized around the principle of multilateralism. And this debate between uni and bilateralism and multilateralism is, of course, extremely active once again. And the fact that the regional orders we had in the past emanating from the same country shows you the tensions in Washington's politics now and in its policy do not date back to the election of 2000 or 9/11. They, in fact, have a much longer standing tradition. I, in fact, trace them back to the beginning of the Republic. So the overall conclusion of the argument is then ours is not a world marked by globalization. It is not a world marked by internationalization. Instead, influenced by national, global, and international forces, yet not determined by any of them, we are increasingly living in a world of regions. Thank you.
That's a vast panorama to cover in 40 minutes, and I'm not quite sure at all where one should begin, so let me open it to the floor and encourage someone to start. Yes.
Oh. I have a question on under the heading of security. You haven't mentioned the United States and Europe in the framework of NATO, which, as I would understand it, was established as a regional institution or structure. And I wonder what your views would be on whether NATO as a regional, if you agree it's a regional structure, can evolve, or is it in danger of breaking down under what seem to me to be three areas of threat or change at the moment. First of all, NATO is moving eastwards to include countries such as Poland and the Baltic states. Secondly, it's changing its original role. It's no longer there to contain the communist bloc. And thirdly, the US, a major member of NATO, looks like becoming increasingly disillusioned with Europe over issues of security, such as international terrorism and Iraq. I'd be interested in your views. Thank you.
I actually looked at the creation of NATO. Because NATO, of course, started as not NATO, but just NAT, There was no OU there until after the Korean War. It was a North Atlantic Treaty. But it's of course, it designates a territorial unit, the North Atlantic, which hadn't really existed until after 1945. And it's actually Ernest Bevin, who is the inventor of this space, in order to keep the Americans engaged in Europe after the end of the Second World War. So there's a particular funny exchange in the Senate when somebody from the administration, I forget now, has to explain to a senator from Kansas why Italy is part of the North Atlantic. And at that stage, the administration said sometimes the laws of geography have to give way to the laws of politics. It turns out, by hindsight, of course, having Italy in the North Atlantic turned out to be extremely important for the 1990s. And I think it's extremely important for the answer to your question. Because the way what I heard you say about NATO was that it was a given unit and that it was natural. And now that the times have changed, that was natural might be broken up. I'd rather think of institutions as investments. And when the investment doesn't pay you, you amortize it in different ways. So I think it is true when you take your second point that its original mission has been lost. That is the threat of the Soviet Union, since there is no Soviet Union, and since Russia, for the foreseeable future, is not a threat. But the other part of NATO, which I pointed to in the lecture, of course, hasn't been totally lost. And the Poles and the Czechs and all those pro-American Eastern countries haven't forgotten about the Germans. So NATO is part of what I would call a reassurance institution. And it may actually become an uncertainty reduction institution, not a military alliance in the way, collective military alliance. And that would be, of course, an institution evolution, which, like the March of Dimes, is unforeseeable, but has a lot of organizational logic to it, and would say that NATO can be looking forward to another 50 years. Double heading or triple heading provisions for troops, let's say 20,000, to fight terrorists in evil states, all included. So I rather think an institution in which the new members have a large interest, in which, after all, the United States, being politically divided as it is, substantial numbers of American and politicians have an interest, right? As long as it doesn't mean that the Americans have to fight European wars, you know, could well have a future. And so I would say, yes, I think NATO is evolving probably to an assurance regime. When Jim Baker gave a speech in December 1989, it was, after all, a speech in which he told the Germans, who had articulated this view since the Hamel Report of 1965 or something, or 56, I can't remember now, one of the two. The Germans had always said NATO is an institution of military defense and political détente. And the Americans had always said NATO is an institution of military defense, period. And in December 1989, Jim Baker says, you win. It is both now. And you will get a recalibration of the political and military requirements. And as we move towards a war on terrorism, which is mostly a war of law enforcement agencies, not of generals, of course, NATO will change.
About the distinction between open and closed regionalism, and perhaps you didn't really have enough time to elaborate on that, but I'm wondering how useful it is. It seems to me that some of the Asian talk about open regionalism in the 90s was making a virtue of many weaknesses. On the European front, Europe is both open and closed. As we know, European trade liberalization has been embedded within broader WTO trade liberalization thanks to American pressure. And so on balance, Europe has been a fairly open form of regionalism in many ways that might not have been expected. Another example in the area that you raised, technology and the Siemens case. One of Siemens' other partners was IBM, of course, in the early 90s on joint chip projects and so on. And in fact, one of the regional programs by which Europe regionalized its technology diffusion, Eureka, proved fairly controversial. Siemens eventually got the others to agree to let IBM, its partner, in. They kept ICL, which was Fujitsu-owned, out because of this perception of Japanese closure with respect to technology diffusion. So it seems to me that in many ways Europe is a fairly open phenomenon, but open, more open to some rather than others, and that's due to the fact that Europe is embedded more broadly within this North Atlantic structure, which goes well beyond NATO. So I wonder how you'd respond to that.
Right. Thank you. I think this is a very important and interesting set of issues for the argument which I'm trying to develop. I think that the openness has different sources and therefore also different manifestations. Thinking about Asia, I mean, take the example of the Asian financial crisis in 1997. And I think your characterization is right. That is, its openness is due, and let me say it in my words, due to the vulnerability of these systems in a globalizing world, taking the language of globalization. And the fact that they couldn't create or didn't want to create a regional order in finance has something to do with that. I think there are now moves. I mean, one of the results has been economic nationalism in Asia has increased. And they may well try to create some form of regional safety mechanism. But it's hard to imagine that any Asian state would do what the Bundesbank did in 1992-1993, which is blow up $50 billion to support the pound and the lira. That's just not in the cards in Asia. Okay. So I think you're right, that it's the vulnerability. Now in Europe, I'd say the source of openness has something to do with what I would call the nature of the national European polities. It's often said that in Asia you get a developmental state, that is, you're compressing the process of development dramatically, in China being the most recent case, and civil society changes come later. In Japan, the 1990s is the decade of civil society change. But that's two or three decades after the economic miracle of the 50s and 60s. So I think Europe isn't as vulnerable internationally. And the source of the openness has something to do with the nature of the European polity, national and European. And therefore, I think openness in Europe is on stronger long-term foundations. Still, that said, if you look just at economic measures, the Japanese and everybody in Asia is very clear that after Seattle, bilateral regional agreements are fine as a stepping stone towards a more open world economy. And Japan is certainly for that. And China, looking at the statistics and recent WTO accession, for reasons of domestic weakness, is also for it.
We go on a long period, but I'm conscious that some of the students here will need to go off and replenish their stocks of biryani and other
things. Biryani always beats lectures, so I know that. So.
Let's pull the formal session to a close. If anyone wants to catch Peter, briefly at the end now, you're very welcome. I'd like to add, having been very good about Cornell in my opening perspective, those of you who might possibly think of visiting it in New York should be reminded that when you get there, it is one of the most beautiful campuses in the world. One of the reasons why professors tend not to leave Cornell is that you can live in great comfort and with beautiful views across the lake and the swallows and the waterfall while you're there. So I encourage you all to think about visiting New York if you can get there. And meanwhile, I would like to thank Professor Katzenstein very much for coming here and for setting out what sounds to be an extremely fascinating argument at book length, which we all look forward to seeing when it is published. Thank you, Peter.